Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's great conversation is with Matty Jacobson. The Final Draft Great Conversations podcast is all about books, writing, and literary culture. I'm Andrew Popel. Every week I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. Final Draft is dedicated to exploring Australian writing, from debut authors to household names. Every week we look into the issues that drive our storytelling and help you discover more from the books you love. These are the stories that make us who we are. 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'm recording on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands and pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands, stolen land, that treaty has never been made in Australia. Matty Jacobson is an author and a playwright. Her novels include What the Light Hides and The Vanishing Act, and today she's joining us with her new novel, The Wingmaker. As the novel begins, Vega arrives at the dilapidated Seafarer's Hotel. Isolated, surrounded by farms and oceans, the hotel promises to be the perfect location to restore the angel with broken wings. It's her most ambitious project yet. But it's not long, though, before a naked man wearing a crown, dive-bombing canaries, and a local tango party threaten to ruin the solitude that Vega is craving. Join me as we discover Matty Jacobson's The Wingmaker. Matty, welcome. Thank you. Thank you for joining us again.
I'm so pleased to be here again and to talk about the book.
This is such an interesting book. It's such an interesting space to occupy. As the novel begins, Vega arrives at the dilapidated Seafarer's Hotel, isolated, surrounded by farms and oceans. The hotel, it promises to be the perfect location to restore the angel with the broken wings, her most ambitious project yet. It's not long, though, before a naked man wearing a crown, dive-bombing canaries, and a local tango party threaten to ruin the solitude Vega is craving. Now, Matty, that introduction barely scratches the surface of what you are talking to us about in The Wingmaker. Can I put it back on you? Can you introduce The Wingmaker to us? Maybe talking about this idea of fixing broken things.
Yeah, it's a funny thing talking about a book once it's completed, because it's such a journey writing a book. And I know for some writers, you know, they start with a fully fleshed out plan of what to write about, and they've got the whole story in their mind. But it doesn't work like that for me. It's kind of a long and very bumpy but wonderful journey. And so when I get to the end of it and having to talk about the book, I kind of have to remember what the book is and what it is about. And that's something that kind of comes to me right towards the end and not always completely clear. So, but the thing about broken things, so what came to me first when I wrote this book was simply the image of a large marble angel with its wings broken. And then, you know, I start asking questions, you know, who's going to fix those wings, you know, and who's this person who's coming into the story, Vega, this woman in her mid-30s who are, you know, she turns out to be broken too. She's had a heart operation. She's been left by her partner and is seeking out some solitude in this old hotel where she's hoping to have the place to herself so she can fix this angel. And kind of in the middle of fixing this angel, she wants to restore some part of her life and her dignity and the way it was in the past. And it's a very big project. It's the biggest she's had up until that date. So there's also the whole sense of, can I actually pull this off? You know, is it a project that I can pull off, and especially in the state that I'm in right now? So that's what's running through her head. And when she arrives, as she said, she discovers that someone is staying in the hotel. And that's not what she planned. And this man who's staying there, he's a war vet, and he's suffering from PTSD. He's also there under the kind of the guys that he's he's going to fix the hotel, but he's a terrible handyman. He's totally lied to get this job. And so he's spending his days reading childhood books and swimming naked in the very cold ocean across the road from the hotel. And so that's kind of the start of the book. And it's for me, it was a perfect setting. I'm interested in relationships, how redemption and healing can come out of relationships that are not perfect from the very beginning. And so that was a perfect setup, you know, what can happen between these two people in great need of healing, and what can happen in that, and especially in that space where there's nowhere to run, you know. And I have to add too that Vega, the main character, is also very scared of the outside. So the whole idea of running is not an easy one for her. She can't just up and go. Plus, there's nowhere else where she can actually fix this angel of hers.
My next question was going to be what came first for you? And you've beautifully anticipated that and responded. But one element that I really was hoping to draw out with that question was this setting of the Seafarer Hotel across from the ocean. It's wild, it's desolate, it's a little run down. I feel like if you put the idea of an abandoned, slightly dilapidated hotel into a sort of a genre machine, it could come up with as many stories as there are genres. There's horror potential, there's romance potential, there's everything there. It's a beautiful setting. Where did the Seafarer Hotel come to you?
To be honest, I'm not quite sure. And that's what I was sort of starting with, this bumpy road, you know, that things just are added as you go along. But I have to say that, you know, I grew up on a very barren coastal road. And so without being completely conscious of drawing on that particular space, it certainly is an atmosphere and visually something that I'm drawn to, you know, the flat landscape, the loneliness that comes with a landscape like that, and the ever presence of the sea is something that I remember as a child, that the sea was kind of almost like a character in my life. You know, it was always there. And I like that. So I guess unconsciously I drew on that part. But the hotel itself, I wanted there to be a place for Vega to go and fix this angel, where I like the idea of empty rooms, of having to occupy a space that's not quite yours. I think that there is something in encountering a space that's not yours, that's not quite made into a home, where you then in turn can possibly encounter yourself. You're not settling into a place, you're not being in a place that's familiar to you. And so, although I'm saying this now, and I think that that's true, but it wasn't like a rational kind of process I had as I was writing it. But I like that. I like that encounter of yourself in an unfamiliar, slightly uncomfortable place.
It's so interesting as well. I mean, I was entranced by the Seafarer Hotel, but from its very first introduction through our point of view with Vega, she's almost stridently against it. For her first impression is that her father Vince has led her astray, and yet we also get the sense of that relationship as being one where she understands what Vince is like. And it almost like I've questioned myself, why could you not predict this? It was like she was either setting herself up to fail, or she was setting herself up with the exact same subconscious process that you've just described. She knew that there was an element of self-sabotage that she would have to rise above in this setting.
I think so too. Yeah, I think she kind of knew. because she's not, as she says at one stage, she's not surprised. It shouldn't surprise her that this is what it's come to. And I do like that. I like that all of the characters, her dad being her sister who comes to join her in the hotel, that they're all flawed, terribly flawed, you know. But I like really flawed characters where there's still sort of life and the possibility of redemption and healing of relationships, you know.
Let's talk a little bit about that. I have so much I want to ask about the characters, but something you've said there has just triggered thoughts. And I know that this is not explicitly referenced in The Wingmaker, but throughout you had me thinking of the Japanese philosophy of wabi-sabi, the appreciation of the beauty in the imperfect, in the impermanent, in the incomplete. And I'll just focus in on Vigor's angel here, because it may never be returned to its former glory. And in fact, within the pages of the novel, there is a sense that we may not see it complete. But for each of the individuals that encounter it, they find beauty in what they see. And they find beauty in what they see in relation to their own life. I wonder, did you have an aesthetic of imperfection in mind in The Wingmaker?
Yes. Well, I think it's just how I try and live my life that comes through in The Wingmaker, really, because I think we can spend our whole life looking for perfection, and it's not really there, either in the people around us or in ourselves or in the world. And I think there is a real art in noticing beautiful things and these are often surprising and not exactly what we think they are, you know. So even with two things come to mind with the novel. So even with the angel, the wings turn out, they're trying to restore. She hasn't got a picture. She's trying to restore those wings. And it turns out that they're very different and kind of a bit odd to what she expected them to be. And she can appreciate that, but it's a surprise. And there's a moment later, without giving too much away, where she's kind of warming to this handyman and then suddenly gets scared by the development of the relationship between them, and then notices the hole in his sock, you know. and so I think there is, when we're open to love and beauty, that we get the privilege of seeing really wonderful things. But when we close off, we notice the hole in the sock and all the negative aspects of imperfection.
I love that you've highlighted there that openness to seeing this beauty, that it's not something that we should assume, that we have to be ready for it. And I very much wanted to pick up on that in Vigor's character. She's extraordinarily complex. And I feel like the beauty of what you do is that you really hint at everything that is going on for her. And really, I want to hear more of her story. I would love if she appeared again. But I was struck by the contrast in the upbringing that she alludes to in the orphanage, and then the life that Vince creates for her when he adopts her with her adoptive sister Susan, the relationship that unravels there. But also the way that contrast, especially that early life, makes it so hard for her to accept more from life. And to follow on from what we were saying, to see that beauty.
I'm not quite sure what to add to that.
Was it something that you were sort of focusing on or ruminating on the formative nature of those early experiences?
Very much so. And I think, you know, anyone who's suffered any kind of lack of love, whatever that might look like in their formative years, that is for sure something that when you get older might stop you from receiving love. And, you know, and she's lucky in citation marks, you know, she's lucky in that she's got she gets adopted by this wonderful man who just absolutely adores her, you know, and her adoptive sister as well. There's this relationship there. It's all available to her, but she is too scared to lose it, to open up to it, which is this funny bind, I think, that you can often find yourself in if you have suffered trauma in your childhood. And so this kind of the daring and the courage that comes with opening up to love is too frightening. And so, because what if then it's taken away from you again? And I think that's something that many can relate to. And I really like that. I actually really enjoyed, it was one of my favorite parts to write, was actually Vega's experience as a child, especially in the orphanage. And I hope that come through that it's not, I wanted a certain lightness to the book so that it's not this kind of heavy realism that is. And that's partly why I sort of introduce the more fantastical elements in it, you know, like the canaries and the hotel that's present and the weird pineapple wallpaper and all sort of the little quirky things. And even in the orphanage, there are a few quirky things in the orphanage as well. But I really, really enjoyed writing about her experience and the pain that she experienced when she was there.
I very much felt like you were playing with ideas around memory and attention as well. You mentioned the canaries, the pineapple wallpaper. There's a particular memory that only recalls to Vega after many experiences. I'm going to be purposefully vague here, but you were very much playing with the idea, it felt, that if we come back to beauty, it is there for us to see, but it is also equally there for us to dismiss. The wallpaper, I'm assuming in the Seafarer Hotel, the wallpaper would not have been a vibrant sort of the yellows and greens of pineapple. It would be certainly faded, and it would be equally as easy to dismiss it and to sort of say, there is faded old wallpaper, not, oh my gosh, what's going on with the quirky pineapple wallpaper?
I think that's such a good observation that you just highlighted, the how easy it is to dismiss beauty as well, or to find, like, to dismiss the possibility of finding beauty in things as well. And I kind of like that when her sister arrives in the hotel, that she immediately sort of notices things and highlight things in the hotel that Vega kind of dismisses when she walks in. So there's that contrast between the two experiences.
Absolutely, yeah. Suze is she's a fantastic character. I want to flip my questions around, because I've realized I might possibly end us on an unnecessarily negative note. So my final question is now about to come to you. I don't really actually know what the question is here, other than I wanted to note that Mark, who is Vega's ex, is the absolute worst. I mean, I sort of saw it coming from a long way off, but then he's the absolute worst. And I mean, we absolutely know that. We know that men can be the absolute worst. We've talked about Vega's traumatic childhood. I wondered about, though, this kind of compounding trauma that she puts herself through in this search for, in scare quotes, normalcy.
Yeah, I think for her, up until the point where she comes to the hotel and everything changes for her, thankfully, up until then, her heart attack, the driving force in her life was to feel safe. And I think that need to feel safe, there's nothing wrong with that. But that can also lead us down really bad paths when it comes to relationships. Because the bar was set very low when it came to Mark. You know, what she got in return for a good night's sleep next to her partner was really not much. And she does talk at a stage about the wanting to feel safe and how good it was that she felt safe when she slept next to him, and she had a friend that said to her, "No, you're really not setting the bar very high. That's kind of your idea of a great relationship." But I did enjoy writing Mark. He was much worse in early drafts, and I actually had a good friend read through it, and she said, "You need to give Mark some humanity." And so I tried. So, but he is still someone who's obviously, he hasn't had the chance. I will be kind to him and say he hasn't had the chance to arrive at a seafarer's hotel and has, you know, hasn't had the chance to have his life turned upside down in a way that Vega does.
The thing that pops into my head, and it's a cliche, but the quote or the idea of the banality of evil, and I really just want to applaud that. What you have highlighted in Mark, as I say, he's the absolute worst, but I feel like men particularly can often fall back on the idea that horrible men are these really active figures. These are the abusers. These are the violent people. Mm. But that it is possible to just be terrible in these very ordinary ways. And you show us this very ordinary way that Mark is just, I'm going to keep coming back to it, the worst. And I felt this challenge, and I just like want, I want to throw it at you, like, men, we need to be better, because we can be so cruel and horrible, and Mark is so cruel and horrible just in his everyday interactions with the world, with Vega. Mm.
Yeah, that's really lovely that you've seen that and highlighting that, and yet there is some. There's always some reason for something, but it's not an excuse, you know, but I am giving a little bit of a reason, and obviously something that he doesn't see the need to work through or better in himself. But he's losing out on Vega, so that's, you know, we as readers know that, so that's good.
He's losing out on a lot in life. I thought that was it was a beautifully humorous touch, the vase with the umbrella in it by his door, which you highlight is, I think, or he brags about that being the only art that he owns. And I was just like, my goodness, this is the sort of person that sees a suburb and wants to render it in some sort of torp rather than leave the brickwork.
Absolutely, he is. Yeah.
Let's flip it, though. Let's flip it and counterpoint Mark with Gunnar. So within the hotel, Vega meets Gunnar. He is our naked crown wearer. He's a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. He's hiding from the world. He's trying to piece his life back together. And for me, this felt especially poignant. I've been reading the book over the last couple of weeks. Because as I've read, we've watched the horror of that war explode as the Allied forces withdraw. Can I start with, did this affect your thinking and your understanding of Gunnar and his story?
Not particularly Afghanistan. Of course, that's impacting me tremendously also at the moment. But war in general and what it does to men, and especially men, or women, of course, as well, but especially as being a majority of people who go to war. I found that very interesting, in the whole idea of going to war, seeing things, doing things, being part of things that are in some parts unspeakable, and then coming home and then, you know, having to function. And I mean, we all know these stories, having to function, going to the supermarket and being completely overwhelmed by what previously was normal, and suddenly feeling alien from a normal, supposedly normal life. And so I was interested in that. And also, but he is so much better, though, knowing that he needs to heal, so much better than Vega is to start with, that he knows that he needs healing. And part of his motivation for that is that he's got a child. He's not with him, but he's very aware of his child when he's there. So it wasn't Afghanistan as a particular place. It was, watched quite a few documentaries on war and war veterans. And it's a difficult thing to write about. And I think trauma is difficult in general to write about, because it's big. You don't want it to be, I don't want it to be cliched in any kind of shape or form the way it's described. At the same time, you have, as a writer, a storyline that you have to serve. You know, you have a journey of a main character you have to serve. So there's that balance between doing that and writing an engaging story, and at the same time giving some information and background on Gonavir, the character that is a war vet, and his experiences, but doing it in a way that is not easy or cliche. You know?
You made the point there that in some senses Gonavir was ahead of Viga in his process of healing, because he actually understood that he needed to heal.
Yeah.
And quite often I feel in a discussion around men and men's relative availability to their own emotions, that's almost presented as the whole story, that men just actually need to realize they have emotions and they are allowed to serve them and they are allowed to discuss them. But of course, Gunnar's story, it parallels, I guess, the story of the wings, in the sense that Viga sits down with the angel, she sits down with the pieces of the wings, she knows she has to fix it, but she cannot see a pattern, she cannot see a beginning. And mm-hmm. for Gunnar, there are stumbling blocks along the way, because when he does start to open up, he is not immediately accepted. And I really liked and appreciated that you showed us that it's not just a linear process from understanding your pain to seeking, finding help and healing, that there are going to be those difficult paths along the way. Mm. It sounds like a very traumatic thing, but it's also incredibly hopeful that we can take those steps and we can recover from stumbles.
Yes, that's really well put. And I like that about Gonner as well, that he sort of goes back to the beginning, so that's all he can think about. So he's not, which he probably would have been really good if he'd gone to therapy, but he goes back to the childhood books that he loved, and to sort of like an innocence that was in his life before, and it's trying to recapture both, and again coming back to beauty, what he finds beautiful, but also an innocence, a way of seeing the world as being hopeful and full of promise, and so he starts there, and I like that. I like that he starts there, and I like that he knows that he needs to start there.
That's absolutely fantastic. And I'll confess, I'm going to cut this out later because it might give too much away, but I confess in my mind I have sort of a post-finale, post-credits scene where Gunnar has successfully restored the Seafarers Hotel in kind of a Wes Anderson type of way.
Oh, I love that.
And and there are weekly tango parties, and Viga is still living there, because it's, I guess in a way, again, I need to cut this, but you leave us with the beginning of potential. You don't close everything up. I don't think we ever see the angel with its wings repaired. Mm. We know that the potential is there, and that's enough.
Mm. Yeah, that is so lovely and well said. And I think it is. Oh, that's a hard one to, as a writer, I think it's a hard one to know where to finish. But I like it there. The being at a starting point where there is hope and there is the potential, and already the sort of the feeling of new life, and you get that the snow is melting and that there is spring coming, both in real life but also in them. But I love your vision of Seafarers Hotel like that. So that's just wonderful.
Yeah, we can have Adrian Brody maybe playing Gunnar, and I don't know, I'm just sort of, I've watched a couple of Wes Anderson films lately, if you can't tell.
I love Wes Anderson films. I love the quirkiness of it. And I have to say that was one thing. So since I last spoke to you, I took on a job. Now I took a redundancy, which has been heavenly. But I taught screenwriting at UNSW for 4 years. And I was kind of thrown into that role, despite the fact that I hadn't actually written a film. So I had to learn very, very quickly. And that has really affected the way I wrote The Wingmaker and also what I'm writing on now. In terms of shape and structure and seeing it as a movie. So I would love it to be a movie at some stage.
It is one of those books because of its how can I express this best? Its brevity but also its density that it could actually be satisfactorily adapted. I mean, you get books of 300 to 400 to 500 pages where inevitably there is a dedicated fan base who will say, why did you cut this minor character who meant so much to me? Whereas I feel like you could fit The Wingmaker in and it wouldn't need to be, you wouldn't need a Snyder cut, so to speak.
Yes, exactly. No, I believe that too. And I think, if you were to make a film, I think you're absolutely right. We'd have to see the Seafarers Hotel in its full glory, you know, just as a last shot.
Yeah. Yeah. That is brilliant. Thank you so much, Mehdi. I'm going to do a bit of an outro for us. Okay. I am speaking with Mehdi Jacobson. We are discussing her new novel, The Wingmaker. It is an extraordinary novel and it has taken me to some wonderful places while I'm sitting in Sydney in lockdown. Mehdi, thank you so much for taking me there and for this conversation.
Oh, Andrew, it was such a pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for this great conversation with Mehdi Jacobson. Mehdi's new novel, The Wingmaker, is out now from Text Publishing. Great Conversations is recorded on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. Stay in touch. We are on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Just look for @FinalDraft2SER. And you can subscribe in your podcast app for a new Great Conversation every week. I'm Andrew Popel. I will be back next week with more great conversations, more great books from Final Draft. Till then, happy reading. Bye for now.